Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. I thought Adam Boileau was due back this week, but he's actually due back next week. So we got some great fill-in guests for you again today. Silverado Policy Accelerator founder Dmitry Alperovich will be joining us, as will Proofpoint's Sherrod DeGrippo and Domain Tools' Joe Slowick. They'll be here in just a minute to talk through all the week's security news. This week's show is brought to you by Airlock Digital. They make what we're calling an execution control platform. Its central feature is allow listing, and in a little bit, you're going to hear why I'm absolutely guzzling their Kool-Aid. What they've built is the anti-VC-funded machine learning-enabled EPP suite. It's like the opposite of that. It's a bunch of sensible and usable controls packaged up into a 7-megabyte agent. It slices, it dices, it slays lol bins and user PowerShell writes, and it comes in this beautiful suede pouch. It's the endpoint protection you get when it's built by practitioners in concert with people who actually understand Windows internals. So, Airlock co-founders David Cottingham and Daniel Schell will be along later on so that I can lavish praise on them. So do stick around for that. But yes, it is on to this week's news segment now with our panel, Sherrod DeGrippo, Joe Slowick, and Dmitry Alperovich. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
And I guess we're going to start off with this news from Malwarebytes. Apparently, they've been caught up in what people are still calling the SolarWinds thing, although we'll talk about that in just a moment. What do we know about what's happened to Malwarebytes here? Let's start with you, Joe.
Well, right now, I mean, it's not much. We know that Malwarebytes was informed by Microsoft, at least based on the Malwarebytes blog post, that they were compromised via tactics similar to the quote-unquote SolarWinds actor or SolarGate actor. And after some investigation, it appeared that while some emails may have been accessed, that not the company's source code and other very important assets don't appear to have been affected.
Okay, so this is just another one. Like last week, we were talking about Mimecast getting a certificate pop. This time, it's Malwarebytes. Seems these attackers are popping up pretty much everywhere. Hence my little comment there about the SolarWinds designation. Sherrod, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Well, I think it gives us all an idea that the information security vendor space is 100% in the crosshairs of very sophisticated actors. One of the big takeaways for me is that Microsoft is finding a lot of these. And so, you know, if Microsoft pops up on the caller ID, you have to get a little scared. This is showing us a lot of the things that we kind of tabletop, you know, ran practices for and made runbooks for. It's coming true. It's becoming the reality that, you know, it used to happen as a one-off, but in the past couple of weeks, these are happening every week and it's changing the game.
Yeah, it is. I mean, a lot of these are popping up now based off notifications that happened in December. There's just this sort of delayed reaction while I guess people finalize their, you know, their cleanup, right? They got to finalize their incident response and figure out what to tell people. Dmitry, FireEye has actually released a tool for auditing networks for the techniques that these attackers have used. It's cool, right? Like they've issued some pretty nice guidance here about what compromise of your Azure AD is going to look like. What did you think of this?
Yeah, and of course, CrowdStrike released a tool a few weeks ago as well. And really, the lesson here is that it's really, really hard to audit Office 365, Azure AD. The logging is really complicated. So the more tools we have like this, and the FireEye tool specifically looks for IOCs of these threat actors to try to identify if you've already been compromised, whereas the CrowdStrike tool is more about auditing who has access to your instances. Both, I think, are very valuable, and people need to appreciate that these environments really are difficult to manage, and you need to keep a watchful eye over them, just like you do over your on-prem networks.
Well, but that's the thing, isn't it? We're not used to keeping an eye out for people adding rogue, federated IDP domains to your Azure AD. Like, that's just not something people are monitoring for, which is probably how this group of attackers have been able to, have such a great time for so long.
Well, and of course, if you think about all the data that we're now storing in Office 365, not just emails, but documents in Azure, you've got the compute instances, you've got Azure AD that interconnects with your on-prem networks oftentimes. So you can just have an incredibly wealthy target-rich environment here by targeting Office 365 and Azure. And that seems to be, by the way, the more common denominator than actually SolarWinds, even though we keep calling it the SolarWinds
stack. No, that's the thing, right? It seems more like a Microsoft Cloud Auth funniness crew than a SolarWinds crew. It just seems to be one. The SolarWinds thing just seems to be one part of this group's activities.
Yeah, you know, we talked about this, that we really need a different name for this campaign or potentially this threat actor, since we haven't gotten distinct attribution just yet on who the threat actor is, although the Kaspersky report really, I think, provides great indication that this is indeed Russian intelligence. So one of the code names that I've heard bandied around by a few people is Holiday Bear, just because everyone's holidays were ruined by this activity late last year.
We had a bit of a discussion about this as well, going into the newsletter yesterday. And, what are we actually trying to clump together here? You know, is it a set of activities? Is it an actor? Is it a campaign? You know, so it's sort of hard to know, what to describe it as, whether or not you want to designate it as a crew or a campaign. So we took the ultimate step of just naming all of this what we're calling hand-wavy Russia stuff is basically the designation that we came up with.
And another consideration, just to jump in here for a second, that I don't think has gotten as much play as it probably should have, is given the duration, complexity, and the multi-levels between the SolarWinds items, the Microsoft Cloud Services items, the use of Cobalt Strike, and now multiple loaders for it, is this doesn't necessarily have to be a single group that's involved here, that we could see a division of labor between different teams with different sets of skills, given the, again, duration and extent of how this campaign has played out. So,
well, you did, you just, Joe, let me cut you off there, because you just mentioned something interesting that we haven't touched on yet, which is there's been a fourth malware sample identified, throughout unpicking this campaign or whatever the hell it is. And Symantec has found this one. It's called Raindrop. What's interesting is it's very similar to another piece of malware that was uncovered through this campaign, and you just sort of left questioning why there are two very similar bits of malware that appear to have been deployed at various stages of this campaign.
So certainly it seems like overkill. Like, we already had Teardrop, why would we need Raindrop, what Symantec called the similar loader for Cobalt Strike Beacon? And the one thing I would caution here is that, like, quite frankly, we just don't know. could this be a anti-evasion or a belt and suspenders mechanism to try to, like, in case one mechanism is burned, this one remains, yet there's still overlaps and similarities. So how robust is that? Really, in my professional opinion, this just goes back to the desire to have additional information and understanding more about this, because there are more questions than there are answers at this point.
You know, one of the most interesting things about all this is when you look at all the different malware that was being used, the Sunspot malware, which is this malware that was deployed on the SolarWinds network, super sophisticated, watching for the build process, injecting dynamically the backdoor into the source code. The Sunburst backdoor, which is the backdoor that was actually injected and ran on all these different organizations' networks, and then the Teardrop and Raindrop second stage implants and shellcode. Super, super sophisticated stuff. And then at the very end, what does the actor do?
Cobalt Strike. I know. It drives me crazy, like, too.
It's like taking a Formula One car from Mercedes and putting a Honda engine in it or something. Why in the world would you do that when Cobalt Strike is so well known? It's so detectable. In fact, that's how ultimately how Palo Alto picked it up on their network. That just was so peculiar to me. I just don't understand it.
No, it drives me crazy as well. It's not right. It's not right that they used Cobalt Strike. But I guess, commodity tools, I don't know, do what's easy, right?
Well, for what it's worth, jumping in here just for a second, there are a couple of items to this. One would be a belief or a justified theory that defenders, when identifying a Cobalt Strike beacon and we don't know where it came from, it must have come from a fish, wouldn't be able to do the dive back in order to identify the SolarWinds or the Azure AD or something else breach. And then the other item, again, is coming back to, was this an access operation that then was handed off to an effects team? And to minimize cross equities or something else along those lines, a commodity tool was used. Again, this just goes to the desire on my end, at least, to get more information about this, because there are a lot of open questions, including like what Dmitry and yourself, Patrick, have said. Why the hell would you go to Cobalt Strike after doing all of these rather exquisite operations previously?
To sort of extend Dmitry's metaphor a little bit, it is a bit like turning a Ferrari into a clown car, right? So it's, yeah, that part of it seemed a bit weird. But look, let's move on to some other stuff now. And Dmitry, you live in Washington, D.C. You are also active in the policy space. So I figure you're the best of our panel to ask about these appointments, because there's all this jostling happening and people being appointed because it's inauguration week in the United States. Rob Joyce is headed back to the United States to take up the post of the director of the NSA Cybersecurity Directorate. I mean, that's it'll be great to have Rob back, right?
Absolutely. Couldn't have named a better person to replace Anne Neuberger, who, of course, is moving to the National Security Council as the first deputy national security advisor for cyber, a really huge position. But Rob, he's just excellent in every single way. He's had, obviously, offensive experience at TAO. He's had defensive experience at IED before that. He's been the cyber coordinator under the Trump administration. So he knows the policy issues inside out. He's got a great credibility with industry. They couldn't have picked a better replacement.
You know, Anne Neuberger, I was going to meet her April last year, hopefully. I'd been invited to an event that she was going to be attending as well, that was in the United States. And of course, unfortunately, I was not able to travel outside of Australia in April last year, but I heard really good things about her as well. So I'm guessing you're also feeling pretty good about her appointment.
She's phenomenal. She's one of the smartest people I've ever met, one of the hardest workers. She's been at NSA, of course, for the last 10, 12 years in different roles. She was the chief risk officer after Snowden, helping to rebuild the agency and the internal security. She's ran the industry outreach and something called the Enduring Security Framework, which was the effort under General Alexander to help fix the bias as well as other issues and introduce security there. So she knows these issues really, really well. Again, has background in both offense and defense, which is super critical. And I think also has great credibility in the private sector.
Yeah. Also, we've got Michael Solmeier. He's headed over to the White House. Is that correct?
That's right. So he will be the senior director for cyber in the White House. Michael most recently was a cybersecurity advisor to General Nakasone up at Cyber Command. Before that, in the Obama administration, he was at Department of Defense, responsible for crafting the cyber strategy. Another superbly capable person. And again, like you look at the theme, all the people that know offense, all the people that have played with defense as well. So I think that's really, really critical for any of these roles, because unless you've played both sides, you really don't appreciate the challenges you face on both defense and offense and how to leverage them for maximum effect.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just looks like wall-to-wall competence. It's really quite weird. It's weird.
And one more position to be filled, of course, the key one is CISA director to replace our friend Chris Krebs. And the word on the street is that it will be Rob Silvers. We'll see if that comes through. But Rob, another great individual, friend of mine that really knows this stuff really well. And more importantly, has been at DHS before, working closely with the new head of DHS, Ali Mayorkas. So he'll actually have a lot of pull in the bureaucracy to get a lot of things done.
Now, look, while we're on the topic of, Inauguration Week and Washington, D.C., I was on Twitter the other day and Thomas Ridd was posting photos from Washington, and they were, it all looks a bit freaky. A lot of boarded up shops, a lot of National Guard troops in town. What's the feeling there at the moment, Dmitry? Because it looks like a pretty, pretty weird situation right now.
We've got more troops in D.C. than we have in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. You can't get within 2 miles of the Capitol at this point, which is definitely weird for us, because D.C. is such a beautiful city, and the inauguration is always a very big event that a lot of people want to participate and be involved in. Of course, not this year because of the events a few weeks ago. So, yeah, everyone is trying to stay far, far away from downtown because you can't even get anywhere close. All the roads are closed. You've got National Guard troops, and more importantly, they're armed. So they have orders to use lethal force, which is also not typical.
Yeah, Rightio. Well, not long to go now before President Grandpa is sworn in. That is happening tomorrow. And I think just right now, as we're recording this, we are waiting to see what Trump's final list of pardons is going to look like. Meanwhile, Sherrod, I want to get your take on this. Caesar has told agencies, government agencies in the United States, to consider rolling out ad blockers to fend off malvertising. Not really sure how I feel about that one. Not really sure if that's the appropriate, you know, use of an organization's resources. What do you think about this?
So I know, I do think that it's relatively decent advice. We absolutely see every single day malvertising as a threat vector. And then on top of that, we see it being used on very mainstream sites. You talk about your number one newspapers, media, biggest websites out there. And the reason for that is the ad agencies, they sell to brokers, to brokers, to brokers, all the way down until it gets incredibly shady. You can buy traffic for pennies on the dollar. And the threat actors say, hey, it's an investment. I'm going to send malware through the ad networks. And it's really hard to get it taken down. So
where it gets a bit dicey for me is surely the effort, in these government organizations would be better spent kind of maybe patching the browsers instead of relying on ad blockers to do this. Because, you know, you've got to worry about the supply chain issues that come with running ad blockers as well, right? That's why I was a bit sort of in both camps on this one.
Yeah, I see your point. It's hard to say. I feel like the browsers are so much more secure than they were before. But at the same time, things like malvertising is coming back. I mean, this is an ancient threat vector. So I don't know. I think it's good advice, but I don't know that it's going to solve the whole problem. So don't be fooled.
I'm kind of with you, Patrick. I don't know that people need to install special extensions and particularly not knowing where they come from. I mean, most browsers have some capabilities built in. I mean, use Brave and it'll block it by default. You don't need any extensions.
Yeah. Joe, what do you think of this?
So I'm all in favor of getting rid of the malvertising or even just intrusive advertising aspect of things because it is a vector for the delivery of bad things. However, like you were saying, Patrick, there is a definite concern in terms of installing applications to manage this for you for a number of reasons. From an enterprise perspective, the ability to monitor, manage, and then sinkhole or block DNS requests, I think, is a very powerful avenue to control over this. And unfortunately, kind of leading into something we discussed last week, is also one that might be less effective moving forward with certain advances or alterations in technology. But overall, this is an avenue worth pursuing because whacking some aspects of this really will take care of, you know, whether you're talking about malvertising, potentially unwanted programs or other buzzwords or whatnot. You know, this is a real thing. The question is the best way to manage it? And perhaps a browser plugin is not the best way, but there are other mechanisms that should be pursued.
Well, I thought you could do this at the DNS level, right? Like, wouldn't that make more sense?
You know, well, just you certainly could, unless, of course, you're using something like DNS over HTTPS or something similar, in which case DNS then becomes opaque, which gets into another advisory.
Well, from NSA, who said you should use your own resolvers, right? If you should run your own DOH resolvers, which is something that we've said on this show like many times over years. I think Caesar said the same thing last year. It's just interesting that NSA released that advice pretty much within a couple of days of the UK standing up, its own resolvers for government workers who are working at home, you know, DOH resolvers. So, you know, it's definitely a thing that people are starting to pay attention to now. But, this idea that you're going to rely on your network kit to grab, clear text DNS off the wire, that's kind of, those days are ending.
Yeah. And for any enterprise, I would say if you're not running your own internal resolver as a first stop shop, then you're probably doing things wrong. And even at the consumer level, for people with a minimal level of technical competency, I'm recommending buying a Raspberry Pi and running a pie hole, or something similar, because DNS remains that soft underbelly for so much activity and still can be a very effective point of mitigation for a lot of malicious activity. So it's not a bad place to start in order to not just alleviate some of the malvertising questions, but to take care of a lot of other items as well.
Sherrod and Dimitri, I want to get your opinion on this next piece, another one from ZDNet, talking about an Iranian campaign that was doing the rounds around Christmas, an SMS spear phishing campaign. Now, Sherrod, I know it's not email related, but were you familiar with this one?
Yeah, so this is APT35, which I really prefer the Charming Kitten moniker. That's one throwback name that I love it. I love it. So we've tracked them for a long time, and they really do focus on things like social media, typo squatting domains. They do email. And so this was kind of novel to see SMS, Credfish. The Iranian actors love Credfish. They love access. They love the ability to get a username and password. And something else that's kind of in that tradecraft friendship between crimeware, using Google. Google Sites is one of the most abused techniques out there. The cloud hosting services really are the new bulletproof infrastructure in a lot of ways. So
this is Google App Engine or whatever?
Right. Or some, you know, you can register and just put up a phish page really easy on Google Sites, and you can create lots and lots of those. So it's interesting to see them using a really common crimeware tactic too. Also, the holiday. That's something that we were surprised to see. There was a significant increase over past years of nation-sponsored APT activity over the Christmas, New Year, winter holidays. And it's likely because of the new administration starting in January. They're trying to get ahead of it before a sweep maybe comes in. But there's no way to know that.
Dimitri, apparently this campaign was targeting members of think tanks, political research centers, university professors. They love going after universities, the Iranians. University professors, journalists, and environmental activists. And these targets located primarily around the Persian Gulf, Europe, and the United States, according to Catalan's reporting. Is that pretty typical of Charming Kitten from what you've observed in the past?
It is. They love to do these broad espionage campaigns where they get into email accounts of a bunch of people, presumably on behalf of the Iranian regime, to provide intelligence. And we saw them doing this around elections with targeted email account targeting of people involved in the presidential campaign. So this is just what they do every single day. And, you know, as Sherrod said, great way to leverage a holiday theme. People tend to click more on links around those types of timeframes. So typical run-of-the-mill stuff.
Moving on to another story here. It's another one from Catalan. As usual, he's responsible for about 50% of the news in our run sheet this week. Joker's Stash, the carding forum, a pretty big one, is apparently going to shut down in mid-February. Joe, do we have any insight into why Joker's Stash is about to disappear?
So unfortunately, we don't quite know. I mean, Intel 471, I believe, put out a report on this as well, diving into some of the details, but it's pretty murky. It could just be that they're cashing out, that they've had their run of success since about 2014, I believe, as the most successful carding forum or the carding exchange out there, and call it quits and time to head to the Maldives or Mallorca or something for vacation.
But not Thailand, because that's where these people always wind up getting arrested by U.S. authorities, right? Like getting
Very
arrested
true.
By the Thais and then extradited. You got to get our Thailand holiday gag in there somewhere. Sherrod, do you think, you know, law enforcement kind of breathing down their neck a little bit could have had something to do with this?
It might have had something to do with it. I don't typically see the law enforcement crackdowns having lots of impact, especially in crimeware. You can always stand up more infrastructure somewhere else. I think that really, I agree with Joe. It's at the top of the market potentially right now. Credit card information doesn't have the same value that it used to have. Chip and PIN has come along. The technology has changed. I really think I would not be surprised if there was possibly a switch from dealing in credit card to going to credentials. We're going to see username and password credentials continue to increase in value. I think that's where the real value is right now.
So what, you reckon Joker's Stash might have just got a little bit legacy?
Yeah, they're old school and I respect that. But dealing in credit card numbers is not the same as it used to be.
Yeah, it's not the the road to riches that it once was. Now, I just wanted to cover this one off quickly because we spoke about this a while ago. This guy, Ardit Farizi, he was the guy from Kosovo who was arrested in Malaysia for sending, you know, for doing SQLI and against some database and then sending the details like the .mil and .gov email addresses of and PII. Of American, you know, government and military employees to Islamic State, which is, you know, a bad idea. Then got arrested and sentenced to a 20-year prison sentence. And we reported a few weeks ago, based on CyberScoop's reporting, that this guy had been given compassionate release. And we were very surprised about that. And it looks like they've found a way to keep him in prison because apparently he was still committing crimes while behind bars. Dimitri, did you catch this one?
I did. And it looks like a good call on the part of the U.S. government here because... you know, if you're not getting rehabilitated in prison, but also doing new crimes, that's definitely a cause for keeping you there for a very, very long time. And
well, it looks like what he was doing is trying to get his family members and friends to monetize like stolen information that he had left behind in various accounts. Like, go get those credit cards and you can sell them to this person and whatever, which is, you know, dumb thing to do.
I guess we can safely say he has not learned his lesson.
Now, this next story comes to us via Zach Whitaker at TechCrunch, and it just screams Joe Slowick. Joe, walk us through this one.
Right. So it turned out that one of the primary name servers, or two, for the country-level domain or top-level domain for the Democratic Republic of Congo.cd was up for what was about to expire and did not appear to be renewed. And a researcher following this, realizing that losing access to an authoritative name server could be a big deal for any .cd domain, monitor it, and then when it came up for re-registration, pounced on it, thankfully, to keep that away from malicious actors. I think the takeaway from this is just emphasizing how rickety or how unusual the infrastructure that underpins the safe operation of the internet really is, because had this domain been lost, the possibilities for a malicious actor to utilize it to forward DNS requests to malicious logon pages or other assets associated with .cd assets would be quite profound. So good on this researcher for doing so.
Yeah, I remember actually, it just reminded me too, Adam once did something very unkind to himself, which is he put in a calendar note for 2 years in the future that just said somewhere a certificate expires. So one day he's sitting there and he gets a calendar notification that just said somewhere a certificate expires and no further detail. And he was very angry at 2 years ago him. Eventually he figured it out, but it was a stressful day. Let's put it that way. It was quite funny. Anyway, Sherrod, I want you to walk us through this next story. This is based on a report from Group IB talking about a so-called scam as a service, which apparently netted $6.5 million in the year 2020.
So I really think that we have to stop referring to things as scams. This is $6.5 million, and that's just one of these. There are trillions of dollars, according to the FBI, that are in play for this kind of fraud. When we talk about stuff like this, it really is an attack. And in fact, this one is using credential fish. So it's pretty similar to a lot of those like puppy scams where you put the deposit down and they ask you to put in credentials and then they ask you to send some money. And instead of email, they're using classified ads. So this is something that we've seen for a long time.
These are your typical classified ad scams where you just list something that looks too good to be true and then you demand a deposit and onwards and onwards and onwards.
And they're also sending a link to a login page so that they can scrape usernames and passwords as well.
So they get your money and your creds. Nice.
Exactly. And here's the thing that's really important to know about Credfish. Credfish is so important in the economy of malware, threat, all of it, because in order to do things like business email compromise, email fraud, email account compromise, you have to have this never-ending stream of fresh credentials. And so where do we get them from? Phishing,
yeah.
Scamming, all of these different things are really sort of the basis, the basic ingredients. These are your staples to get into all of the other attacks that we see. I also do not love this name that they came up with. So I decided that we're going to call it Craig's Fish or Venmo money more problems.
Because they call it class a scam. But yeah, I mean, I guess what you're saying here is this isn't just about stealing a bit of money. This is providing a flowing stream of valuable creds that are going to wind up God knows where else.
Absolutely. And those credentials will be used for further attacks every single time.
Oh, last week we spoke about how Signal was picking up a whole bunch of users because WhatsApp updated their privacy policy and people are freaking out about it. Signal actually fell over, which isn't, I mean, there's ways in which Signal has sucked in the past. It's been pretty stable for me lately, but I can't recall it having fallen over for an extended period before. And I think what made this interesting is because if Signal had gone down like a year or two ago, it wouldn't have really bothered me, but it made me realize how much I use it now.
Yeah, and that's a really good observation because we're starting to get migrated into a field where there are fewer and fewer trusted communication platforms from a truly end-to-end communication security, non-monetization standpoint. I mean, you have things like Telegram and Wire and whatnot that are out there, but Signal has kind of risen to become the gold standard, especially when you start talking about non-technical audiences like journalists, activists, and similar. And so while, you know, downtimes happen, DDoS by user happens, for it to happen so quickly after Signal was highlighted as being a very enticing alternative to WhatsApp is kind of unfortunate. At the same time, I'm still using it, so it's not going away.
I think they tweeted out some stats on, like, they had like 40 million new users join in like 1 or 2 days, right? And they said they'd literally been like upgrading their capacity as fast as they could, and they just couldn't keep up, right? Which is going to happen. When you get an influx like that, it's going to happen.
Which just means for everyone that uses Signal, go donate and help make them do their mission better.
The most interesting thing is how indispensable Signal has become, not just for private sector folks, but even people in government that I know for sensitive communications, when they don't have anything else around, may resort to Signal. And I was wondering, during that 24 plus hours when Signal was down, how many of those sensitive calls were happening just over regular lines because people didn't have anything else handy that they could trust.
Yeah, I know politicians here are all about WhatsApp groups, right? I don't know if they've since moved to Signal, because I think Signal still limits groups to 8 people, doesn't it?
I think they just expanded it to eight persons. I think it was 6 previously.
Yeah. So I think WhatsApp would be the one that's critical enough that would cause governments to stop working, actually, because they actually have decent group limits. And Dimitri, I know you wanted to talk about this one. A researcher, John Page, apparently got a little bit bored being stuck at home because of the vid, and created a website called malvuln.com, which is going to be a repository of like malware O-Day. So like vulnerabilities actually in malware. It's a cool idea.
I think it's a really cool idea, and I'm surprised it hasn't happened before. I know some folks like Felix Letter have in the past given some talks on vulnerabilities they find in malware. Most malware is actually not well written and has tons and tons of vulnerabilities and exploitations you can use against them. And this one can cut both ways, right? So on one hand, it can be helpful to defenders, both private sector and government, to try to shut down malware using those vulnerabilities, either in mass, sort of similar to the way Cyber Command just tried to shut down TrickBot, not using a vulnerability in this particular case, but they could have. If you're an incident response team trying to clean up, this is something that you may end up using if you have no other better way to clean up a large network. But on the other hand, for attackers, this is yet another way that they can get in. If you have a malware that's running with systems privileges, as it's often prone to do, and you find a privilege escalation in it, vulnerability in it, well, guess what? You don't need to elevate privileges anymore once you're inside the network. So this is the type of thing that both offense and defense likes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know certain SIGINT people are kind of interested in this sort of stuff, because if you've got a known bug in a bit of malware, and, you know, usually they're using really insecure C2, so if you can get in the middle of that somehow, you can pop shells using someone else's malware, and that's great, because when someone rolls IR, you can, you know, it's going to look like commodity malware. I mean, I don't know if this project is going to float, right? Like, they've launched this site. I hope it turns into a bit of a community, but it might just fizzle. Let's see.
Yeah, and there's so much malware out there that's going to be really, really hard to keep up and keep up with both the analysis and the exploit writing for this. But it's a cool idea, and hopefully others will contribute.
Now, we got a couple of skateboarding dogs to include in this week's run sheet. One is that the FBI are apparently investigating whether or not a woman who was involved in the Capitol riot actually stole a laptop from Nancy Pelosi's office and planned to sell it to Russia. But, I mean, we got to take this with a grain of salt because the person who made that allegation, the person who signed that affidavit was, like, I think her ex-partner. So, yeah. Take that one with a grain of salt. We got another great one from Catalan, which is two kids playing around on their dad's computer. They were like just mashing the keyboard on his computer, which was running Linux Mint. And they actually found a way to bypass the screen lock just by mashing the keyboard. So that resulted in a patch and a CVE, actually. So that's really funny that their screen lock couldn't withstand the kid mashing the keyboard technique. But just before we go, we've got some late breaking news, Dimitri, that you wanted to discuss with us. It's an executive order from Trump, which will be, you know, I'm guessing one of the last things he ever does as U.S. president.
Yeah, maybe the last one, who knows? But this one is actually a great one and a really important one. So related to SolarWinds, one of the things that the adversaries did really well is they procured infrastructure exclusively in the United States, knowing that it's really difficult for U.S. law enforcement and specifically the U.S. intel community to track that. And particularly when they're using foreign resellers, they can switch accounts easily. So even if one set of accounts is discovered, they got others standing at the ready. And basically, this executive order forces these cloud companies, this infrastructure as a service companies, to do KYC, know your customer processes on their foreign customers, so that you would know at the end of the day, as much as you can know, who the ultimate customer is, and make it much more difficult for foreign cybercrime actors as well as nation states to procure infrastructure in the United States. I think it's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of wonder how workable that's going to be, though. I mean, I'm speaking as someone who actually uses US-based services, right? And like, how are they going to go through a KYC process with me? Like, is this something that is actually achievable?
They may force you to send your passport, just like when you open up a bank account, you have to fill out tons and tons of information, send your driver's licenses, notarized documents. They may require SIM processes.
But that's what I'm saying. Do you think that's workable? Because that sounds like it's going to be a completely onerous set of requirements for the average infrastructure provider, particularly the small ones.
Quite possibly. There are exemptions in this executive order where the Secretary of Commerce can exempt certain providers. But I think the big ones for sure, Microsoft, AWS, and Google certainly have the capabilities to do so.
Joe?
Yeah, so from a big provider standpoint, I definitely agree with Dimitri here, but it'll be interesting from a threat actor standpoint because we saw with, for example, the SolarWinds or Holiday Bear, whatever the hell we're calling this campaign, Azure and AWS featured prominently in hosting for infrastructure. I wonder if in the future we'll see a regression back to HostSailor, Hetzinger, and Shinjiru and other non-US VPS providers as the sort of hosting items of last resort, which might be a win for defenders because there's lots of things that are there on those networks.
Maybe, but I think it's more likely we'll see people selling photoshopped passports with ML generated pictures on them for, you know, $20 a pop. That's my guess.
Well, also true.
Why not just buy some creds?
Yeah, or to Sherrod's point, just get the creds somewhere else. I don't know how much this is going to do, but, you know, this is a story that broke 10 minutes ago, right? So it's going to be hard for us to have the on-point analysis immediately. But that's actually it for the news. I've looked through. Apparently, the latest pardon list is about to drop imminently, they say. And then we get to see if, the real question is whether or not Edward Snowden and Julian Assange will get a pardon. And of course, Joe Exotic, that's another big, that's the big one. We'll just have to wait and see. But I want to thank all of you for joining me to talk through the week's news. Sherrod DiGrippo, Joe Slowick, Dimitri Alperovic, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
Big thanks to our panel of news guests for taking the time to contribute to this week's show. And as of our time of recording and editing, still no word on those presidential pardons. So I guess that's something we'll pick up next week. It is time for our sponsor interview now with David Cottingham and Daniel Shell from Airlock Digital. So, in the interests of full disclosure, I have been doing some work with these guys, and I can't really say what I've been doing, but I can say that I've been able to take a peek at their books, and things are going well for Airlock Digital. Their business is booming right now, which is surprising to some, given the central feature of their product, which is allow listing, formerly known as whitelisting. That central feature was more or less rejected by the security market on its first couple of go-arounds. And it was rejected for good reasons. Early allow listing software was fiddly, it was hard to set up, it was hard to manage, and it was trivial to bypass. So it was always a concept that sounded good, but was difficult to implement. And, you know, even Microsoft AppLocker is a bit of a shit show. Anyone listening to this who's had to wrangle with it would know. So I think you can guess what I'm going to say next. Airlock is doing well because their implementation is good. But that's not the only factor, really. Allow listing is a poisoned category, so just doing it well isn't really enough to resuscitate it like they've been able to. So let's look at a few of the factors here. One factor is they've actually built a whole suite of features, like the ability to disable all of the lol bins on your Windows boxes. I mean, that's handy in and of itself. One feature that's just about to be merged into the GA release of their product is the ability to disable certain types of execution rights for user groups. So if you don't want normal users to be able to use PowerShell, no problem. You can just click a few, you know, ticky boxes and it's done. And that type of control, yeah, it's pretty cool and it's going down well among users. Another feature that's roadmapped is the ability to block certain macro content types. Statically detecting a malicious macro is actually pretty hard, but dynamic content type blocking is actually pretty easy and pretty effective because there's a handful of content types that are never non-malicious, right? So you add all of this up, and what you have is essentially an execution control platform that's really easy to use. So they've spent a lot of time on the allow listing workflow elements of their product. So yes, it is actually easy to use. So again, I have been doing some work with these guys, and I can tell you that their typical sale process goes something like this. A customer comes along and says, we'd like 200 licenses for this set of machines because we have a regulatory requirement to fulfill. Then 2 months later, they come back and they say, we'd like another 5,000 licenses, please. You know, basically, once people have used it, they go all in. And Airlock's license retention rate is 97%. So look, I've just given you a pretty hard sell on their product. I think it's great. But that still doesn't explain where their leads are coming from. Why is a product in a completely dead category getting love? So there's a single word answer to that, and that word is ransomware. In the past, CISOs couldn't propose controls to management that could impact productivity. Jason or Aisha in accounts losing SAP access for 20 minutes was seen as too big of a risk or too big of a productivity hit. But these days, everyone is so scared of ransomware that they don't care about minor theoretical productivity hits anymore. Jason and Aisha can suck it. Not that they have to, because those productivity concerns aren't really a thing anymore. That's more of an issue with the, you know, first go around products in this space that got rejected for good reason. So I guess what I'm saying is I feel like allow listing is back. And in my view, it's going to move more into the mainstream. I don't think it's necessarily going to eat the entire EPP market, but it is back. Daniel and David, join me now, and you guys have been listening to me read this intro, and I'm going to go out on a wild limb and guess that you agree with me on what I've just said. But look, I'd like to ask you, I'd like to get your thoughts, your words on this. David, how much of a factor do you think ransomware has been in sort of bringing allow listing back from the dead? Because originally, you set up this company as a niche player to help Australian government departments fulfill their sort of their obligations vis-a-vis allow listing. And now you're sort of in this much bigger market than you expected. Do you think it's ransomware that's done that?
100%. I believe it's played a significant part in, I guess, allow listing being almost a required control today. Existing security solutions are just not delivering the protection that people are seeking from their current products. Ransomware has also elevated, I guess, the threat of cybersecurity to the board level. They see a direct impact as a result of those attacks. And now boards are saying, you know, cybersecurity is a critical agenda for their business. And the threat landscape's getting worse rather than getting better. So proactive security controls, you know, particularly allow listening, something that, you know, we're clearly passionate about, passionate enough that it drove us to build this product in a market that you said was largely ignored because we had to get the security level that we needed to protect customers against these type of attacks. And also, regulatory compliance is an increasing driver for allow listing. You know, the Australian government, one of many countries, has been saying since 2013 that allow listing is the most effective control that you can implement in your networks, and that is continuing today, you know, 8 years later.
It's funny that, though, because it's sort of a controversial thing what the Australian government did in terms of issuing that guidance, because they're like, everyone should do it, but the tooling sucked, which is why you exist. But it was just, you know, it's a bit of a funny old situation, that one.
Yeah, there was definitely, as I said, we were created out of a need. You know, we responded as security practitioners ourselves to implementing allow listing based on that guidance. And we just found it too hard to the point where it drove us to create an endpoint security company to make this better. But I guess we're in a fantastic position where we've come from is we've really understood the challenges on the ground. And most of the challenges aren't just, you know, there are security products out there that can allow or block files. It's about how you instrument that process, which is the key to making it successful. You have to operationalize proactive security controls, particularly allow listing, inside businesses if it's going to work. I actually wrote a SANS course, which 2 out of 3 days of the course was teaching students how to implement allow listing inside their organizations. And they came away from the course, this was before Airlock existed, and said it's too hard. Throughout the development of that course, you know, we spent a significant amount of time thinking about what the actual challenges were. And one of the biggest challenges was, I need to join this WebEx, I'm this end user, how do I do it quickly? You know, and let me to get on with my day without slowing down the business, but having the security control of allow listing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of ways around that, right? You've built like self-service workflows, but you can also just do publisher allow listing.
Exactly right. And one of the great things about, you know, the recent years is developers are signing their files, or companies are signing their files, and publisher whitelisting is now practical at scale, where we don't really think it was 10 years ago. You know, you look at the Microsoft Windows code base, the overwhelming majority of files are signed now. So you can do things like you can trust the Microsoft publishers, and then that's all you need to do in order to allow the whole base operating system to execute.
Microsoft, yeah, allow Microsoft, because if they get owned, I mean, you're done, right? Yeah. So trusting them, it's fine. Trust Google? Yeah, trust Google. Cisco, oh, maybe. Adobe, oh, they did get owned once before and their build environment got owned, and oh, supply chain. But, you know, you can eliminate a lot of the heavy lift by just allowing certain publishers.
Exactly right. And we spend a significant amount of time, I guess, putting that message out to customers about that exact trust decision, because some customers are apprehensive about trusting, you know, particular vendors. But equally, one thing we find interesting is it's almost the first time they've actually thought about that problem. You know, before they think about something like allow listing, things just run and they just deploy things. But when they're actually looking at, okay, do I actually trust this? You know, the wheels start to turn in terms of the type of companies that they're allowing into that environment. And especially in light of, you know, the modern supply chain security, you know, emerging issues, which is going to become worse. These are things that people just really need to start thinking about generally, aside from allow listing. But the process makes you perform that risk calculation, which is really important.
So I'm a massive fanboy of a few of the sponsors of this program, right? CMD is another one, because they make, I mean, their control, it's not about allow listing, but they essentially do execution control at like the command level, which makes, you know, which makes a lot of sense. It's like, yeah, execution control is good, is what I'm going for, because it just seems that, like, it's crazy that in 2021 we're in this situation where people can just sort of execute whatever they want on corporate systems and the only seatbelt you've got there is your EPP, it just doesn't really make sense. And, you know, thinking through, obviously, because I've been working with you guys, I've been thinking through, like, what would it have looked like if you were an Airlock customer who was also a SolarWinds user? And first of all, yeah, you would have got an indication something was up because those DLLs weren't signed. But really where it would have been useful, and really where your stuff is quite useful, is in stopping and then detecting attempted lateral movement. I want to bring Daniel in now to talk about a case study. This story here that I want to get you to tell, Daniel, it's a case study that I've, you know, that I know about from an Airlock customer, which is just, it's just fantastic. It's not so much about lateral movement, but it gives you a bit of an idea about how this sort of approach is useful. Walk us through the case study, Daniel.
So, you know, this was a defense contractor organization that were informed by a government agency that they'd been breached, which is often the case and how these things come about. You know, and then they worked with the government agency to go through the incident response and cleanup project. And, you know, as part of, I guess, of, you know, remediation and security uplift, you know, the Australian Essential 8 strategies were deployed. And one of them is, of course, the top one is allow listing. And Airlock was deployed and then we got to that enforcement mode. You know, our end goal, with our, where you get the proactive protection, within a week. And then pretty much like a year later, RDP was opened up to the internet to allow a vendor to do some maintenance work on a database server. And, you know, and within hours of that, you know, RDP session being reopened or, you know, found back on the internet, they were alerted from the Airlock console that WinRAR had been blocked. You know, WinRAR.exe was blocked on their SQL server. You know, and that was a pretty high quality indicator that something wasn't right. You know, they could see by looking at the command line parameters of the WinRAR attempted WinRAR execution that, you know, someone was trying to zip up their you know, SQL databases.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want WinRAR running on your production SQL boxes, right? And yeah, I mean, that's great that it was blocked. But I mean, this is the other thing about allow listing, right? Is once you get your environment under control, the amount of telemetry that you have to analyze really reduces, right? Which makes every signal kind of more valuable. This is what I really like about the CMD stuff as well, which again, isn't about allow listing, but it's that same approach, which is why don't we control execution in an environment?
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, WinRAR's got no business being on a SQL server. And so, you know, it's just a principle of least privilege type thing.
It's security basics, right?
Yeah, fundamental control, right?
Yeah.
I think what I would say there as well is so much of security is about context. You know, we all run the same base computing systems, but we all use them in different ways and we have a different appetite for risk, right? And if you can provide, you know, contextual security, which, you know, with something like allow listing, you can build up custom rule sets for that are defined to your organization, that's where you really get the security benefit from at the end of the day, because every single organization has a different rule set and you don't run into the problem where when the endpoint security market traditionally delivers you security with signatures, they have to take a one-size-fits-all approach. And the problem with that is that something that's malicious for one customer may be, you know, a core part of their business for another. You know, take tools like PeerSecExec, for example. You know, some small organizations may use it for administration in some circumstances. There's probably better examples than that, but you understand the point. Okay?
Yeah, no, and that's the thing, right, is you can disable all of the stuff that you don't need. And we should probably explain too, like you probably freaked people out by saying, you know, you can customize it for your organization because that sounds like a lot of work, but it really isn't because you guys deploy. It's like a learning mode and then you know, that gives you your baseline and you go from there, right? So it's not, and that brings up another topic. And this is something that I talk about with Haroon Mir a lot, which is building something that appears to be simple is actually quite hard. You've put about 6 years of engineering into this.
Making it simple is the core challenge to us. You know, we're not just a kernel driver on the endpoint that's allowing or blocking files. The majority of our product engineering is spent actually building the processes in order to build the rule set for that. You know, what some of our competitors in the space boast firewall-like application policies, for example. And that is the exact opposite thing to what we're trying to achieve here. You know, that a firewall-like policy means nothing to someone that's looking at it, let alone being able to instrument a workflow that the organization can operationalize. One of the most important things that we say is that we don't build this tool for security people, even though it is a security tool. We build it for the people that are deploying software, we build it for the service desk, you know, to actually jump in, manage this day to day, and then escalate the security problems to the security team.
Well, it's probably worth noting that the people who typically drive this solution in an organization, it's not the security team, it winds up being the desktop team. You know, security brings it in, but desktop teams manage it.
Yes, that's very true. And it can't be the security team that does it. You know, they've got, you know, if they end up doing it, then they often lack the context of, you know, what software is being deployed, how users are using it, because they're concentrating on security incidents and other matters inside the organization.
It's probably worth noting too that one benefit here is that if you redirect a little bit of effort towards managing your environment this way, you are actually reducing a lot of SOC workload spent chasing down weird stuff. You know, like, it just knocks out a lot of the weird stuff in your environment.
Yeah, for sure. You know, allow those things as a strategy that, you know, an organization will choose to implement, and it reaches across the whole organization. And it's, you know, allowing the right people to have the right tools, like, you know, allowing those the customer service or the help desk sort of organizations, you know, give exceptions when they need to in a quick way. And, you know, a big part of our solution is having the right workflows that support all these different use cases based on, you know, what we've seen and how organizations operate. You know, I have a lot of calls where I sort of help customers sort of work through how they're going to, you know, hook into different workflows and such. And, you know, the thing that we always come back to is, how does your business operate now for, like, deploying patches and updates and such like that? And then we find a workflow in our solution that matches the way they do it, rather than trying to have the customer rejig their workflows, you know, to something that they might not want to do or is too much work for them to do. So depending on, you know, customers are at different levels of maturity. So we, you know, try to align workflows that are appropriate for them.
Yeah. So just on that SOC question, I think one thing that Daniel also always mentions to me as well is that, you know, if the call tree doesn't exist in the woods, does it even happen? Is that the analogy you use, Daniel?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Like, if you block the execution in the first instance, then you don't get all the other subsequent alerts for
that's
that.
Kinda,
right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at, right? Is you spend so much less time chasing down both real incidents of commodity malware and stuff that actually didn't wind up going anywhere. You know, it just it just quietens everything. It's the silence, the silence of the seams.
It's sort of like the MITRE attack pass, right? Like, if you are blocking the initial code execution in the first place on the sort of the left-hand side of the MITRE map, then you don't need to worry about a lot of the advanced techniques that are all the way down the chain. And a lot of the endpoint security market is focused on that end, you know, detecting MS Build being abused in a certain way, detecting malware on disk. That's sort of, it's great, but that's sort of the symptoms we see, you know, because how did that happen in the first place? And if you can get as close as you can with security fundamentals, things like allow listing, as you mentioned, you
it's
know,
like shift left for ops, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, bring it as far forward as possible, you know.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, you're going to have to use that as a tagline. But guys, that's all we're going to have time for. Thank you so much for joining us to talk through some of this allow listing stuff. Anyone who's interested in taking AirLock out for a hoon can get in touch with them and organize a free trial. It's been a pleasure to chat to both of you. And we'll be talking soon.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
That was AirLock Digital's Daniel Schell and David Cottingham there. Big thanks to them for that. And seriously, do go check out their stuff. It solves a lot of problems. As you can tell, I am a big fan, genuinely a big fan. Just a warning though, their website is trash. It is really quite bad, but it's also trash that Google really loves. So they're kind of scared to update it. And I think that's reasonable. But yeah, do go get a trial, play around with AirLock Digital. Let me know what you think of it. I am, of course, Risky Business, one word, on Twitter. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.